The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by Isabel Hardman and James Forsyth. So it's day two of the fallout from the A-level results, and so far we're thinking about what's going to happen in future years. Something's been mooted today about potentially changing the grading system of A-levels. James, can you explain what's going on with that?
So there's a big debate about how do you squeeze this grade inflation out of a system. You know, this year, almost 45% of A-level entries got either an A or an A star. That's up from 25% in 2019, when the last year when you had normal exams marked in the normal fashion. And I think this idea of moving to a 9-to-1 system, you know, I think the appeal of this has not been lost on senior figures at the Department for Education. You couldn't obviously do it in time for next year's exams, which are already going to be adjusted to make them easier for people. So, you know, for example, the government has already consulted on giving students advance notice of what topics are likely to come up in which papers. But I think the appeal of this is it will essentially enable from 2023 a reset of the current system, and it would be you would be rebasing the grading, and it would be very clear to universities and employers whether people had sat these last years of a COVID adjusted exams or sat the new exam. And I think the danger is that because of people deferring university entry and the like, people compete against people from other years. So you can't just pull the plaster off and have one year when you snap back to the old system. And I think the appeal of this is that if you were to do this in the fairest way possible, squeezing it out a little bit every year, that could take up to a decade. If it takes up to a decade, I think it is almost inevitable that elite universities will start introducing their own admissions test. And so what you need to do is come up with a solution to that problem. And the 9-to-1 situation does that. It has another advantage in that it allows you to have more differentiation at the top, because essentially right now you have A and A star. Under this 1-to-9 system, you would have 7, 8, 9, with 9 acting in almost as a kind of double A star grade. And I think one of the other appeals to the people in government is this is already the system that is now being introduced for GCSEs. And the view in Whitehall is that transition from GCSEs, from lettered grades to numbered grades, has worked quite successfully. And I think if you look at a Tory party which wants to say that it curbed grade inflation, and it had success at this. You know, in 2010 when the Tories came to office, more than a third of A-level entries were rated A or A star. In 2019, as we were just saying, that was down to a quarter. I think this is probably the fairest and simplest way to get on top of this problem.
Isabel, this is one of the methods that's been mooted, but the question that comes to mind is whether or not Gavin Williamson, the current Education Secretary, will be the person to oversee something like this change, because there's speculation in Westminster that he might be replaced.
Yes, I mean, there's been speculation about his position for, a year now, actually, given the erosion of his authority that he saw over the mutant algorithm last year. And I spoke to one of his colleagues in the Conservative Party a few months ago who described him as basically being a roadkill, with the unions feasting off his carcass, which I thought was a colourful way of putting it. But yes, the speculation continues, and the latest suggestion is that Kemi Badenoch could replace him as Education Secretary. Now, she is I'd say a rising star within the sort of junior ministerial ranks. She is very good at facing down the Labour Party in the Commons, or indeed sometimes igniting and inflaming rows on certain issues. She's not a retiring character, and that's really impressed Downing Street, because she's good at going to war with the left on woke issues, which is something that they admire. Also, quite a handy skill if you're going to have a fight with the teaching unions over education reform, which is something that tends to happen whenever education secretaries, particularly Tory education secretaries, try to change and shake up systems. So that is one of the suggestions. I think, though, it's reasonable to conclude that Williamson is going to struggle to hold on to his job. And once again, there's been reporting that he's been saying, "I know where the bodies are buried," and all that sort of thing, which has always been his sort of muttered threat ever since, I think even before the time he was chief whip with a tarantula on his desk, and something that he's tried to remind prime ministers of by keeping a whip on his desk even as education secretary, which has been slightly bizarre. but it is difficult to see how he could continue in the job with the need for a national recovery scheme that is more ambitious and better funded than the one that the government has at the moment, and that will involve having a standoff with the Treasury. And the person you want in that job is somebody who knows how to fight their corner, and somebody who also has the political capital to make the Chancellor worried about them, rather than for the Chancellor to think, no, actually, we don't need to worry about Gavin, which I think is where we are at the moment.
James, last week there was a new report from the Institute for Government which basically looked over the educational kerfuffle throughout the pandemic. And the image that they painted was one of Gavin Williamson being sidelined throughout a lot of this process. Do you think that he is long for the job, or this is just rumours, or do you think Boris Johnson has to move him somewhere else into cabinet, or is he going to lose a cabinet seat altogether?
I think a kind of cabinet reshuffle is overdue. I also think that, and in some ways, because Matt Hancock had to resign, this question has been parked. In some ways, those people who've been at the forefront in delivery departments of handling COVID, there was always going to be an argument for changing them round, because that they would find it easier to say, you know, to put some distance between the decisions that their predecessor had to make, and to kind of emphasise kind of recovery rather than defending decisions taken during the pandemic. I think the criticism you can make of the Department for Education, which came out in that Institute for Government report that you referred to, is, you know, but obviously the best solution to this is to be able to have proper exams. But I think that wasn't possible because of COVID. But I think we have to kind of go back to why it wasn't. And it wasn't because of the deficiencies and disparities in remote learning. And I think those deficiencies and disparities in the first lockdown were understandable. You were expecting to turn a system based on in-person attendance round. I think some of the problems that you had with the shutdown of schools that started in January, it was less bad than it was first time round, but there was still clearly a large variety in provision. And some of that is the lessons, also some of that, and is the environment in which children were able to learn, which is, I think, harder to hold the Secretary of State for Education to account for. But I think one thing that is worrying when you look at this rise in the gap between private schools and state schools is the number of educationalists who are saying, well, it's not that surprising because private schools manage to kind of have more online lessons and keep more normal school, in inverted commas, going through the pandemic. So I think that's the criticism that you can make of DfE, was that perhaps a lack of contingency planning, which meant that they had to fall back on teacher assessed grades. And these teacher assessed grades, I think people are saying, oh, teachers have been unprofessional at so many kids have been holidays. I don't think that's fair. I just think that what you're finding is that in every marginal case, people by human nature will tend to fall on the more generous side. And I think that one of the other things that we learned last year was that the algorithm creates hard cases. That if you are basically to go through and say, oh, that we should mark down some certain number of kids in this class because traditionally this class does not get this many top marks, people find that almost random selection of someone to be marked down as just offending against a basic sense of fairness.
Mm. And Isabel, I guess speaking of fairness, James has written a great piece on Coffee House today about the booster shots that are coming in, not just this autumn, but the Times is reporting next autumn, which obviously would delay any donations of vaccines from the West to the rest of the world. Can you talk us through what the government is thinking on booster shots?
Yes, yeah, so our vaccination programme is obviously something that ministers are very proud of, that they're very proud of the way in which it was rolled out. They're very proud of the levels of take-up within this country as well. But there are plans to give people, particularly the over 50s, booster shots this autumn, and then again in autumn 2022. And one of the commitments that the UK has made on vaccines globally is that it will donate a certain number of vaccines, but it won't prioritise this above its own domestic supply of vaccines. And as James says, the problem with this is that you've got richer countries placing orders for booster shots, putting further pressure on vaccine supplies, which makes it even harder for developing countries to order their own supplies, aside from the donations that may or may not be coming their way. And the UK has, and other developed countries, have been really quite strongly criticised for the paucity of their donations to the developing world, or even indeed their commitments rather than their actual physical donations so far to the developing world. And this isn't just about a principle. It's also pragmatically that if you have a lot of countries in the world whose vaccine rollout of their first round of immunisations is massively behind or almost a non-starter, then you have the potential for new variants, potentially more virulent ones, to develop, and then in our globalised world to spread more easily back to the UK, and therefore making this a UK problem, because as we've seen with the Delta variant, it undermines our own vaccination program if we have variants coming in that are more resistant to the vaccine.
And James, this also leaves a gap for countries like China and Russia to slide in, doesn't it? I mean, I've been looking at vaccine diplomacy this year, but also, you know, in Southeast Asia, there's a lot of vaccine skepticism of the Chinese jabs that they have there. But what you hear a lot from people is actually, well, it's either this or nothing, because frankly, we don't have enough Pfizers and Modernas and AstraZenecas to go around.
I think one of the problems here is because of the way that vaccines are produced, you can't just ramp up production. You need these bioreactors. It takes time. You can't be certain of the yield you're going to get out of each one. But I think there is an issue here, which is Israel is doing booster shots. The EU is doing booster shots. The UK is doing booster shots. The US, having been quite sceptical of the idea of booster shots, is now moving in that direction. We're expecting an announcement from the CDC on that on Friday. And I think if you look at all this, and you look at the fact that different vaccines appear to be effective against different variants, the result is that developed wealthy countries are very reluctant to give up any vaccine supply, to donate large amounts to COVAX. But as you said, Cindy, until you can get the world immunised, resuming normal international travel and the functioning of the global economy is going to be very hard. You know, for example, I was reading an article earlier today about how the Christmas shopping season threatens to be impacted by the fact that there are COVID outbreaks at a Chinese port, and that China struggles in dealing with the Delta variant. You know, the nature, and I think one of the things that is tricky here is that no national politician is ever going to say, oh, I've made the decision not to give booster shots to my own population and give them some boost in their immunity, however limited, because I've decided it's more important to vaccinate the rest of the world. I think the problem you're going to get into here is I think we are heading towards a situation where for at least the next few years, developed countries regard vaccinating their own population as a bit like painting the fourth bridge. You know, you do it and then every autumn you come round with another set of booster shots for the over 50s or for the clinically vulnerable. And I think that is just going to really slow down this whole process of vaccinating the rest of the world, particularly given the production difficulties associated with some of the vaccines that are by the public perceived as being most effective, you know, and the mRNA vaccines.
Jameson as well, thanks very much, and do join us again tomorrow.